Money FM 89.3, best of the evening runway. Eurowatch.
Money FM 89.3. It is the evening runway. I'm Elliot Danker. Time now to take a look at headlines out of the European region. Now, to start us off, after years of negotiations, the European Parliament has approved a major reform tightening the EU's migration and asylum rules. Now, the European Pact on Migration and Asylum has entered its final phase. We've got officials meeting in Brussels yesterday to vote on whether or not to approve the far-reaching reform of Europe's migration policy. This has been quite a talking point for a number of years. Now, this migration pact provides for tighter control of migrant arrivals into the EU and the introduction of a solidarity mechanism between EU member states concerning the distribution of refugees. What's next from here and how will this affect the entire migration policy in Europe? On the line with me is Dr. Samia Puri, Associate Fellow UK in the World Programme at Chatham House. Dr. Samia, good afternoon. How are you?
Hi, Elliot. Very well. Nice to speak to you. Very well rested after a great midweek holiday.
I know. We all needed it, right? But let's talk about this migration issue. I mean, first of all, this is something that's been going on for years. If you've traveled to Europe enough, you pay attention, you see this so-called problem. The European Parliament now approving a controversial shakeup of the bloc's migration system. It advocates to better protect its borders, so to speak. Tell us a little bit about this latest evolution.
Yeah, so this is a really, really big policy issue across European countries. And this is an EU asylum and migration pact. It's actually been worked on since 2015. So anyone out there who's worked in sort of the legal profession or in passing laws will know that this sort of legislation involving so many different countries, it takes a very long time. And I mean, we'll come to the pact in a second, but obviously why 2015? Well, that was the huge upsurge in migration after the Syria conflict worsened, yes, if we remember. And Angela Merkel and the German Chancellor famously sort of spoke about an open border to migrants in a very altruistic way, but a way that was very hard to manage and had big political impact. So, I mean, it's kind of a mandatory solidarity is what the EU has said between the member states. And it's going to probably receive full approval at the end of April after some major voting. But the EU27 countries, they're either required to take in thousands of migrants from frontline countries, or they're expected to provide extra funding or resources instead. So there's an idea of burden sharing, given the fact each country is differently exposed to where migrants are coming from, and that one of the big complaints is always that some countries have to bear a bigger burden than others.
I witnessed it for myself, the migrant situation from Syria back in 2015, 2016, while I was in Spain. And you see in terms of, you know, how they try to make a living, you know, selling things, and you've got police trying to chase them down. You also see some of them are homeless at the train stations. It's quite a shocking thing to see it for yourself. And now, with regard to this one, you've got some interpreting the plans as an effort to counter the rise of the far right ahead of course, European elections that are set to happen in June. Dr. Samia, what's your take on that claim?
Well, do you know, on that point about how this pact might actually help with those things that their actual problem, I mean, obviously, entering a country with nothing, having been dispossessed, having fled conflict or persecution or you know, trying to better your life from extreme poverty. I mean, the chances that you end up in further poverty when you arrive in Brussels or Paris or elsewhere, as you're mentioning, it's very possible. I mean, this agreement is trying to commit to dealing with asylum requests within a maximum of 12 weeks. And if they're rejected, that the asylum seekers would have to be forcibly returned home. So it's quite tough. And it means that those populist politicians across different European countries, Germany, elsewhere, Netherlands, of course, they, when they claim that the Brussels arrangements are weak on letting in migrants, that actually there's a counter argument and that there is actual policy to deal with this quickly, but that doesn't counteract the likely continuation of things that we've got used to seeing in the news, very sad things of migrants arriving across the Mediterranean into Italy or Greece in large numbers across small, dangerous-looking boats. So the arrival part, it's not going to stem, but it's going to provide greater legislation and greater parity between how different countries treat these migrants when they arrive.
All right. Doctor, let's move on to Switzerland, who yesterday said it'll organize a high-level peace conference for Ukraine in mid-June. Without Russia, Ukraine and up to 100 countries would attend the conference at the luxury Birkenstock Resort. Now, the Swiss president, Viola Amherd, said the event will not see a peace plan sign. So at least she's starting the process. At least something is happening here. Although one would say the biggest hurdle is still Russia having to agree to it.
Yes, I mean, it's obviously really positive. I mean, generations of us have been brought up with Switzerland's neutrality as an important. Given that Sweden and Finland have joined NATO quite recently, becoming the 31st, 32nd NATO member states, there really aren't that many sort of Central and Western European countries left that could possibly reach out to Russia and try to engage them. But the issue is that if Russia isn't involved, then there's a sort of a so what factor to this peace forum, this peace summit. We obviously have to wait and see, but I cannot imagine. Obviously, Putin himself is not going to travel.
Yep.
Would Sergei Lavrov, I mean, he's still got the rounds. Would he travel? It's not totally impossible, but surely the incompatibility in the positions, which is Zelensky in Ukraine and all of his backers say Russia must withdraw fully from Ukraine, occupied Ukraine, for those discussion of end of hostilities. Russia clearly says that the territories it annexed in September 2022 are now part of Russia, even if they only partially hold those and they're still advancing with their army. And by the time we get to this mid-June moment, which is not far away, by the way, when this is scheduled, one cannot see the conflict having moved in any other direction, Russia having eked out a few more kilometres of territory with even less incentive to compromise. So obviously, I'd love to think that there's an optimism around this, and I think it's great that it will be happening, given how much money is being spent on supporting Ukraine's military. There needs to be more spent on diplomacy. Last observation on this, Elliot, is wider world engagement. Let's see which other non-Western countries are invited to participate and to air their views and to have some sort of involvement. Because that's the other interesting side to Switzerland hosting this. They could engage some other countries that want to see an end to this conflict and they don't think it's going to be a military end.
So it's interesting, Doctor. You started out by saying traditionally neutral Switzerland. But I don't know about you, but as we were discussing this and as you were talking about this, don't you feel that this whole idea of neutrality is no longer a case of, hey, we're neutral, we're not getting involved, versus this is not my problem? So it's like there is pressure for Switzerland to get involved, even if it's to offer their land as a sort of neutral meeting ground. At the same time, you've got Russia slamming this event as a US orchestrated plot. So if President Biden appears, how does this look on Switzerland's part?
That's a really interesting point you made about what is neutrality, especially in this day and age. And, you know, given Switzerland is where it is, it obviously collaborates quite heavily with Western militaries.
Yeah.
Switzerland has moved a little bit closer to NATO, not to join NATO, but very understandably, because there's so much insecurity in Europe now. And, you know, I mean, any country that is ostensibly, quote-unquote, neutral, it's about, I think, balancing its relationships with different parties. And it's a lot of it's about the perception of being approachable rather than, you know, maybe preachy or condemnatory as parties that can't traditionally engage with each other see each other as being. But in terms of Switzerland's neutrality, its peak diplomatic prowess was in the Cold War. Okay. I think if memory serves, the first Gorbachev and Reagan summit, direct face-to-face, was in Geneva, I think in 1985. Yeah. And neutrality and the reputation for being a convener has to be refreshed with every successive generation. There is possibility that actually when this peace event happens in June, the impression one is left with, I'm not saying this is the impression, but it could be that Switzerland is basically, it's a Western European country, and it doesn't really have that power to engage the Russians at this moment in time.
Just a little bit about the Russia-Ukraine conflict before I get back to Switzerland, Doctor. Donald Trump, who is set to run for presidency at the end of the year, he thinks it's not appropriate to visit Ukraine as a presidential candidate. Yet, over the weekend, the Washington Post reported that Trump had privately said he could end the war by pressuring Ukraine to cede Crimea and the Donbas border region to Russia. We have had private conversations and in our own speculation, and I'm sure other people have, thought about the possibility of some kind of a DMZ because this conflict is going nowhere. Doctor, what are your thoughts on Trump's claim here?
Right. So there's one quick historical background here. When Trump was first president, he tried, before the big Russian invasion, he tried to orchestrate a deal to end the limited conflict in the Donbass, which was basically to persuade the Ukrainians to give it up and to have local elections. And that backroom deal was run by a guy called Paul Manafort, who was later, I think, ran into some severe difficulties as a Trump aide and a Republican campaigner, was dealing with Viktor Yanukovych, the then Ukrainian president. So there's Trump actually has some form in doing a sort of a background preparatory deal he thinks could sort out Ukraine. And I think his incentive is always to try and get the Russians not so much on side with America, but less conflictual so that the Americans can focus on China. That's his very, I think, simple take on it. What's the possibility of actually succeeding in this deal? Well, I've got to say, if your military is entirely or very heavily dependent on American military assistance and that assistance is turned off, as it has been with the congressional issues we've talked about in the past, if there's a definitive end to American military support on a large scale to Ukraine, and let's say it starts with a Trump presidency next January, next February, well, then Zelensky is in dire, dire straits because the Europeans, Western Europeans, can't pick up all of that slack. Could the Ukrainians keep fighting, or will they be forced to pursue some other option? Probably the latter. It would be, I mean, the pyrotechnics of that, as the Europeans and the Ukrainians accuse Trump of giving up security in Europe and all the rest of it, it will be chaotic, but at a very hard bargaining level, there is some logic, because unlike in 2018-19, when Trump first pitched around ending that limited war in Ukraine, this time, if American aid to Ukraine stops, Ukrainians are actually in trouble in the long term.
Okay, well, let's close that one off, Doctor, and go back to Switzerland, the country joining the European Sky Shield Initiative air defense umbrella. It's designed to build an integrated air and missile defense system across Europe. And it kind of comes back to that discussion we had earlier. What is neutral today?
Yeah. Yes. And you know, actually, this is the example that was really in my mind when we were talking about Switzerland, because let's think about defending your airspace when you are a landlocked, more or less, you know, country in Europe. I mean, how can you demarcate your land space as neutral? If someone starts flinging missiles over Western Europe, I don't think those missiles are going to necessarily, you know, maneuver to avoid Switzerland. So there is some logic, I think, in understanding what air defense means across Western Europe writ large. There's no reason for Switzerland to sit that out. It would be diminishing of Switzerland's own defenses. Switzerland, by the way, like Singapore, has national service. So they've always taken their defense very seriously. Swiss people, all young people, always have tales of their military service. So you've got to really, I think, bring that defensive attitude into the modern era. And I think that is very much part of why Switzerland's Federal Council has actually approved its participation, its country's participation in European Sky Shield Initiative, Air Defense Umbrella, as it's called. And that, I think, is when you see, just the last comment on this earlier, when you see those heartbreaking images of missiles being flung at Ukraine, cruise missiles, glide missiles, glide bombs. I mean, no one's saying that's going to happen to Western Europe, but any policymaker in this day and age would take prudent measures to make sure that their alliances, their friendships, their neighbourhood arrangements are in tune with the level of threat that you could face. And I think that's what Switzerland has sensibly done.
Okay, final issue I want to talk about, young Simon Harris, who takes over as the Republic of Ireland's youngest ever Prime Minister. His birthday is on the 17th of October, 1986. Just a day before mine, except he's a lot younger. What were you doing at 37 years old, Doctor? What does he bring to the table here?
Yeah, well, what was I doing at 37 years old? Well, we'll come to that later on. But, well, the good thing for Simon Harris is he's got a nice shock of sort of greying hair, which gives him a good air. I don't think you necessarily look at him and think he's 37. But hey, listen, all credit to the Republic of Ireland. They've had a Taoiseach, which is the name for an Irish Prime Minister. By the way, I worked on the Irish peace process many, many years ago. I worked for the UK government. And I had to learn how to pronounce Taoiseach, which is the Gaelic name for Irish Prime Minister. Leo Varadkar, his ancestry was, you know, part Indian. And now we've got an extremely young Taoiseach. So, you know, there's a lot of pathbreaking been happening recently. So there is some sort of symbolism there. He's from Fine Gael, and I wouldn't, you know, even begin to try to explain Irish politics, but Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil are the two Irish political parties. And he's been the only candidate to seek the party leadership after Leo Varadkar resigned. Leo Varadkar resigned quite suddenly. And you know, let's see. Ireland, I think, is the country that is going to become more important as the years go by, especially because of Brexit.
Yes.
Giving the EU that anchorage in that part of the, sort of, you know, across the channel, if you like. And also, I think, because, you know, Ireland's economy, which went through a horrible period during the financial crash in 2008, you know, has a lot of potential.
All right. And they're calling him TikTok Taoiseach because of his age as well. If you want to read more about some of the discussions that Dr. Samia Puri and I have just had, you might want to check out this new newsletter that Dr. Samia has launched, Geopolitics Recharge. Doctor, tell us a bit about this.
Absolutely. Listen, you probably, many listeners, have heard of Substack. Mine is a totally free newsletter. It's a great way for authors to connect with their audiences. Yeah, I've written a bunch of books, but I don't tend to write short form very much. And this is a great opportunity to write real quick, 800-900 words, little geopolitics reflections and updates that you can be emailed to your inbox. All you need to do is to go to samirpuri.substack.com. That's samirpuri.substack.com. It's called Geopolitics Recharged, and you'll see the first post just went live today, and I'm really pleased to be able to do it because it's a really nice way to engage with audiences who read your work without them having to wait 3 or 4 years to your next book. And of course, the world moves on very quickly, as we talk about on this show, and I think there's a lot of things that people can gain from hearing insights from people who work on these issues on a more daily basis if you're only dipping into them, you know, intermittently now and again or out of personal interest.
Should be quite interesting. Go check it out. I've been speaking with Dr. Samia Puri, Associate Fellow UK in the World Programme at Chatham House. Doctor, thank you again for your time.
Thanks, Elliot. Have a great rest of the week.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at audio.sg or download the audio app. That's AWEDIO, audio at the App Store and Google Play.